Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this Saturday morning, October 3rd. Happy October. Ah, I love this time of year. The colors, the autumn scents, the crisp air. Really, really a great time of year. So I hope you're having a great weekend so far. And so glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 7 to 8. Right here on WLIW 88.3 FM, heard live online at www.wliw.org. And each sports interview show is archived on my website at annliguori.com. That's annliguori.com. And then we distribute it on podcasts as well under the Sports Interview Podcast. So you can find us everywhere. Well, this morning, we will visit with one of the foremost golf landscape artists of our time. Her name is Linda Harto, and she has painted some of the most memorable and gorgeous holes at some of the most prestigious golf courses around the world. And her work is displayed in the permanent collections at such legendary clubs as Augusta National, Pinehurst, Pine Valley. Jack Nicklaus owns her paintings, Raymond Floyd, Reese Jones, to name a few. And her paintings are part of the collections of the USGA Museum and the Morris Museum of Art in Augusta, Georgia. She is constantly working on various commissions and just a fascinating woman and artist. And we'll get to know Linda Harto and hear about her process, how she captures the natural beauty in her paintings and brings in the game's history and tradition and even the metaphysical part of the game. So all that in my interview with Linda Harto. And then in the second half of the show, I'll replay an interview I did with none other than Alex Lifeson of the band Rush. He is a very passionate golfer, and it's always a pleasure to have some time with this legendary guitarist. Just one of my favorite interviews always. All right, let's first look at some of the top sports stories. And the NFL, they have added more COVID protocols for teams following positive COVID-19 results after the Tennessee Titans outbreak postponed their game with the Pittsburgh Steelers. Teams will have to add a second COVID test daily, including on game days. All meetings will be virtual, and players and staff will have to wear face coverings and gloves at practice, with only quarterbacks allowed to keep their throwing hands uncovered. There are new limits now on how many people can be in the weight room at any given time, and teams can't hold any gatherings away from the facility. The Titans-Steelers game, which was supposed to be played tomorrow, is postponed until later this season because of the league's first COVID-19 outbreak. All right, well, the New York Jets are winless, continually winless, now 0-4, after losing to the Broncos on Thursday evening, 37-28. Sam Darnold put the Jets ahead early in the game, but to no avail, as the Jets had 11 penalties, which cost them 118 yards overall in the game, 8 in the first half, all of which extended all 4 Broncos scoring drives. Broncos quarterback Brett Rypien, the nephew of 1992 Super Bowl MVP Mark Rypien, became the first quarterback to win his first start with 3 interceptions since 1997. Then Giants, who are 0-3, will play the 2-1 Rams on Sunday in Los Angeles. Game time is 4 p.m. on Fox. Daniel Jones will make his 16th career start on Sunday. And in his first 15 starts, he's thrown 16 interceptions and has had 13 fumbles for the Giants. At the French Open, well, we know that Serena Williams had to withdraw this past Wednesday, just hours before her second round match, because of her left Achilles injury. Now, her next opportunity to go for a record-tying major win, number 24, will have to wait until the Australian Open, which normally is played in January. Sloane Stephens lost in the second round for her earliest exit at the French Open since 2011, when she lost in the first round in 2011. She lost to a Spanish player named Paula Badosa in 3 sets. In the NBA, Doc Rivers was hired to coach the Philadelphia 76ers. Rivers takes over for Brett Brown, who was fired after the 76ers were swept in the first round of the Eastern Conference playoffs. Rivers was fired about 2 weeks after the Clippers were up 3-1 in the Western Conference semifinals and then lost to the Denver Nuggets. Doc Rivers was with the Clippers for 7 seasons. He's also coached the Orlando Magic and the Boston Celtics, winning the NBA title with the Celtics in 2008. A little baseball, we have the Yankees and Tampa Bay Rays. They will play Game 1 of the American League Division Series in California on Monday. And the Yankees, after that epic 10-9 victory over the Indians this past week, that game lasting 4 hours and 50 minutes, which was the longest 9-inning contest ever played on a major league field. The Tampa Bay Rays own the American League's best record, and they're the league's number one seed in these playoffs. The Yankees were the American League's favorite coming into the season before an up-and-down regular season dropped them down to the 5th seed. Sports Interview with Anne LaGorie is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. Dune, D-U-N-E, jewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses, zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. Peak Vision, P-E-A-K, vision.com. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne LaGorie, and my guest is world-renowned golf landscape artist, Linda Harto. Linda, you painted some of the most memorable and beautiful holes at some of the most prestigious golf courses in the world. What a career you've had. Your work is displayed in the permanent collections of such legendary clubs as Augusta National, Laurel Valley, Pinehurst, Pine Valley. And personalities such as Jack Nicklaus, Raymond Floyd, Reese Jones, just to name a few, actually have many of your paintings in their own collections, as do the USGA Museum, the Morris Museum of Art in Augusta, Georgia. I could go on and on, but I'm honored to have you on Sports Interview. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, it's an honor to be here as well. It has been a wonderful career. It still is, but... it's been over, about 36 years now that I've been doing almost exclusively golf courses. So
let's go back. How did you get started in painting? I understand you were an artist as a child?
Yeah, I think it's been my focus my whole life, literally realizing it at the age of 6 when I was already doing lots of artwork and people would remark on it, and I suddenly realized that not everybody could do that. So it sort of defined me then, and I pretty much stuck to that my whole life.
Where did you grow up, Linda?
I was born in New Jersey. We moved to Wilmington, Delaware, then Louisville, Kentucky, and then I went to the Art Institute of Chicago in... stayed there for a while, and then I came down here. So,
and you down here is Spring Island, which is a private island off of Hilton Head, South Carolina.
Right.
Is that a great spot to paint?
Yes, it's gorgeous. You know, I have there's a lot of nature preserve on Spring Island, and that's all I look out on is trees, and it's like a sanctuary to me, so I'm very happy here.
So how did you become so connected to golf?
Well, it happened in the early 80s. I was exhibiting my work in a gallery on Hilton Head, the Red Piano Gallery, and I think it was Frank Christian. Do you remember Frank Christian Jr.? He was the photographer at Augusta National then.
Oh, right. Yes.
And he saw my work, and I guess both the pros there, Dave Spencer especially, was looking for artists to paint some holes at Augusta. And he recommended me And so, yeah, we started a relationship in 1984 with Augusta.
Wow. It doesn't get any better than that.
No, it really doesn't hurt to start at the top.
I mean, where do you go from there?
Well, I've thought in retrospect many times that I did a lot of commission work then, you know, anyway. So it was not anything unusual for me to do this. But in retrospect, I think had it been any other course, it probably would have been one and done.
And interesting.
Yeah, because from that one first commission, I started getting commissions from other golf clubs almost immediately.
Right.
And by 1988, only 4 years later, I was doing nothing but golf. And in 1990, I started my U.S. Open Series and also the Open Championship Series.
Were you a golfer?
No. My father was an avid golfer. When we were in Louisville, you know, we used the club, Big Spring Golf Club. And I would go there, and I did take lessons, and I played some when I was young, but it really didn't stick.
So you don't really play, but you feel obviously.
No, I'm an avid. I call myself an avid watcher.
Right. Well, you have to be to paint these incredible, you know, golf landscapes.
Yes, I really love the game. I love every aspect of it. It's I follow every bit of it. The history, the traditions, and I try to, you know, show that in my paintings too. That
sure.
Perspective.
It comes out in 1984, so Augusta National Golf Club commissioned you to paint their famous 13th hole.
That's right.
And, gosh, just what was it like that very first one when you went to Augusta National? What do you remember?
Well, it was pretty overwhelming as a landscape. When I actually painted the painting, I had to kind of rethink grass a little bit because I had been painting a lot of landscape, and of course, there isn't another landscape much in the world that has the contours like you see on a green or a fairway. So I had to kind of rethink that. You couldn't show much texture, you know, it's just completely different. But once I got over that, it was okay. And then I kind of liked the differences. I liked to be able to see the ground contour. You don't get to see the ground contour everywhere in landscape. You know, every little roll and nuance and how the light hits it. That just doesn't happen much in most nature. So.
Right. And your paintings certainly do bring out that texture, that rich texture and the contours that you're talking about.
Yeah. I find it really fascinating to see the way the light goes over the contours of the green and fairway, and it's really interesting.
Yeah, so take us back, because I think it's fascinating. When you went to Augusta National, do you take photographs, or what's the process like? What happened then, that very first?
Yeah, I took photographs, and also Frank Christian, you know, loaded me with photographs, but... But I have always taken my own photographic reference for every painting I've ever done, really, since about the 60s, I guess. And so that's just part of what I do. I use the camera to get the information I need, basically.
Right. So you're not actually physically sitting at Augusta National painting while you're looking at the 13th hole, or are you?
No. I don't work that way.
Right.
I've tried doing drawings before, but really it's mostly I've learned how to use the camera to get all my reference material. So.
Right. So you bring these photographs back to your studio and you paint from your studio on Spring Island?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I see. Because it looks like, I can just picture you, you know, when when you think of artists, whether, you know, landscape artists or portrait artists, you think of the person being like right there and like
well,
Van
yeah.
Gogh out in the fields.
Well, I don't paint really fast, for one thing.
Right.
And another thing is you can't be in play. Most all the courses I go to are people are actually playing.
Sure.
So you
yeah,
have
you
to
couldn't
sort of,
be there. You'd be dodging golf balls, right?
Exactly.
But
doesn't
it
doesn't work
be,
really well.
It wouldn't be a bad office for sure if you had to sit there for days to do this painting. But so how long does it take from start to finish to complete one of your
oh, Lord.
golf landscape paintings?
Depending on the size, you know, of course. But most average at least 3 months, sometimes
mm-hmm.
four, sometimes six. And then there's all the production that follows after that. You know, it goes to the printer or the digital capture and then proofing the prints. And so the whole process, that can add an extra month at least to the process.
Right.
So if I get
right.
three or four done a year, I'm doing good.
Wow. Okay. Well, yeah, that's a lot. Three or
mm-hmm.
four a year based on all the time that goes into it, as you say, the process, that's a lot. So, for instance, you were so kind to donate a replica of your painting of the famous 13th hole at Augusta National, you know, for our Anne LaGoy Foundation Charity Golf Classic, which I'm getting framed and which we
Good.
Will auction
yeah.
off.
Great.
So tell us about that. So is that, it looks like it's the actual authentic oil painting. It's just so real. But what actually is it?
It's a canvas G-clay print. Most all the printing I'm doing now is canvas, on canvas. And it really
right.
replicates the original. The person that does my digital captures, he's somewhat of a genius, I think.
Yeah.
And he has been able, I've been working with him since, oh gosh, 1994, I guess. And he's able to do the digital capture to not only capture the texture of the paint, which comes through when you print it on canvas, you actually feel like you can touch the texture.
Right. Yeah,
and
definitely notice the difference.
Yeah, he's just amazing how he can capture that.
Because it looks like the original oil, it looks like the original
mm-hmm.
painting. It's uncanny. So now
know,
does Augusta National got your original, is that correct?
Yes, they did. Yes.
And then from that painting and all the other ones you've done, how many holes have you painted at Augusta National?
Well, let's see. About nine different holes, but probably about 30-some paintings overall, because I did a lot of paintings of the same holes.
Right.
Because
different
versions of it. Commercially, you know, as far as selling prints, you know, people want the main ones.
Right.
I did the fourth, the sixth, and the eighth holes, but they were done as a master's gift.
Oh, wow.
Jack Stevens had started that. So I did that for 3 years. And that was really the only time I got to paint anything from the front nine.
Mm-hmm.
All the other paintings have been on the back nine.
What a lovely gift. And now you're saying that all the prints are on this canvas G clay?
Mostly. I still do paper prints, but mostly mm-hmm. everything is on canvas. And everyone
yeah.
seems to like that.
Oh, it looks so you authentic.
Know. Yeah. It's just a different look from a paper print because you have to put glass over it and mats and all that kind of stuff. So.
Right. Now, on your website, you have a gorgeous mm-hmm. painting that you did of the ninth hole, the ninth green at Wingfoot, who
mm-hmm.
hosted the 2020 U.S. Open,
right.
and the beautiful clubhouse behind it. The texture and the rich colors come out so beautifully. Talk about that painting, Linda, and when did you start that,
well,
and how did that go?
I actually did that painting for the 2006 U.S. Open.
Okay.
And it still pretty much looks like that. I noticed they took out a few more trees.
Right.
Actually, they took out a lot of trees over that course since
yeah,
I was
that's
there.
Been the trend.
Yeah, but it still pretty much looks the same, fortunately.
And how do you decide on the lighting? Is it from pictures that you take, or do you decide,
yeah,
I'm going to make it look, you know, this way from a lighting perspective, or is that strictly from photographs?
No, that's mainly when I go to the course, I look at it in all the different lights and decide which ones I like. It's usually a morning or an afternoon lighting.
Right. My guest is world-renowned golf landscape artist Linda Harto, who just is so talented, and you're so accomplished at what you do. And as you say, you continually work, you know, you do work for the USGA. I got the National Open Championship. What have been some of your most memorable paintings to you personally?
Oh, wow. Well, the ones at Augusta, of course. But I really love the Scottish courses. It's been quite an experience. I used to go over there every year. And I just grew to love the look of those courses so much.
The Lynx courses, yeah.
Yeah, just the way, you know, the combination of the natural landscape and I just love the way it looks over there. It's just so natural.
Very natural. I love playing. Lynx course is my favorite golf destination, is Ireland and Scotland for sure. And
yeah,
it's because of those Lynx courses, the beauty and the natural terrain and the everything that's, you know, that comes with that. It
yeah
is just so inspiring to me. I play my best golf on those Lynx courses because I think I'm just so inspired by the scenery.
Well, you know, it's not just that either. I think you get a real sense of history there. I mean, it's like ghosts, you know.
Right.
You really don't get that over here, but over there I became aware of it almost immediately, and it really changed the whole way I approached, I think, the whole idea of painting golf landscape.
In what way? I know you have such a deep respect for the game's history and tradition.
I think it was sort of like tuning into the metaphysical side of golf.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow you become aware of that over there.
You're absolutely right.
Tangible.
Yeah. Yeah, the tradition of golf and
mm-hmm
the history just you feel it there, right? As you
yeah
said.
Yeah, you really do. It's tangible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and how do you capture that in your work?
You know, I don't know how to explain it, but when I went to Scotland
yeah
and my agent then, which is Bob Pringle, he took me all over Scotland, showed me all kinds of things, and we even salmon fished and everything.
Fun.
And then he took me to St. Andrews and just left me there. He put me in a bed and breakfast and just said, I'll see you in a week.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, this was, you know, my first trip to Scotland, right? And so I was there. I was. I had nothing to do but wander all over St. Andrews and the course and the town.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, you know, it just did something to me, I think.
Right.
It was just you were immersed in it there. And
right. Yeah, it's very spiritual.
Point,
you walk through the town and the cemetery,
yeah,
and you see, you know, the gravesite of all
yeah
these incredible golf course designers, and just very spiritualized.
Yeah, yeah, very special. And after that, I was putting actual people in the paintings. And after that, I didn't ever again. I never have put people in the painting. It was like because when you put them in there, it becomes a narrative rather than a feeling.
I see.
So I was trying to really zone you into the feeling of being mm-hmm. there.
Right.
And other things that would distract that feeling just didn't get put in. So.
Right. I was going to ask you about that, if you ever thought you'd want to paint additional subjects like portraits or more paintings with people, but then I think
I've done that in my career. I've done portraits, mm-hmm. I've done equine portraits, I've done you name it, I've painted it. But I don't much now. I think I would like to go back and do some more just landscape, but I do mostly commission work now. I don't work at the tournaments much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that keeps me busy. I'm happy, you know, just doing that now and not having to go to all the tournaments. Oh, I miss them, but I like it.
Right. I mean, I would see you every year signing, you know, yeah. various prints at the U.S. Opens.
Mm-hmm.
Do you not do that anymore?
No. After I hit the 25th one I had done, that was at Pinehurst in 2014, I decided to retire from tournament work. So
right. And now you spend more time at home painting.
Yes. That's wonderful. And doing other things. Imagine that.
Oh, my goodness. Have you done Ireland courses?
Yes. Yes, I've done. I've been all over Ireland, but I've only painted Ballybunion and Royal County Down.
Right. The beauty of Ireland to me is not only, you know, the special Lynx courses and parkland courses, the scenery, but also the hospitality of the people. That just,
yeah.
that to me just takes over, you know, anytime I go to Ireland. But, you know, whether you're at St. Andrews and you're feeling old Tom Morris right
mm-hmm.
there.
Yeah, definitely.
And all the tradition at the birthplace of golf, or whether you're in Ireland or in our country,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have an uncanny ability to really bring out that metaphysical feeling as you describe, which that is a real art form. I mean, it's just, I don't think anybody else does that. And you've been recognized as the 2017 inductee into the Low Country Golf Hall of Fame. You've been honored with the Golf Digest Lifetime Achievement Award. You've gotten, you know, a lot of recognition, but I'm wondering, for all your incredible work, Linda, do you feel like, you know, you've gotten the recognition you deserve in the golf world for your work?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm always happy when I used to do the tournament work, you know, where I was at U.S. Open or at the Masters, it was always wonderful when people come up to me and say, oh, I have this print or that print, and it meant so much. And, you know, that's just so gratifying. It just makes you feel so good.
Right. So, it's good to get that kind of feedback when you're out and about like that.
And now even just doing private commissions for clubs, it's the same kind of feeling. You know, it's just a gratification to kind of be able to do that and have everybody so pleased with the results. And
sure, I can imagine. Do you ever have to say no? Do you ever have to say no to the request because you can only paint so many per year?
Yeah, I do.
Right.
I mean, you know, I have to like it too. And
right.
you get some unusual requests. And I have to turn down a lot of them. There's a lot I'd like to do that I basically just work on commission now. I don't do them just for the fun of doing them as
right.
much as I'd like to. There's certain ones I would do that with, but there's an awful lot that I would have to have a commission for because I just can't afford to put that kind of time and effort into something that has no monetary value, I have to say.
Sure.
You know, it's how I make my living, and that's that.
Absolutely. What about, is there a hole out there yet to be painted by Linda Harto that you just have to put on your list that you haven't done yet?
Oh, yeah, there's a few. I'd say maybe the 15th at Cypress Point. I've always wanted to do that, just never have. And I love the look of Bandon Dunes. I have not been there. I have been to Cypress Point, but then again, that's very much like some of the UK courses in
Right.
Scotland.
Yeah,
So I
we're
guess that's
excited. We're
probably.
going. We're going to Bandon Dunes for the first time in a couple
Oh.
weeks. I'm very looking forward to it. We're used to going to Ireland every year, so this would be our Bandon Dunes, kind of like that Lynx like experience. And so, have you never painted anything at Cypress Point?
No, I've been there many times, but it was just kind of a club thing. I couldn't get permission, and I didn't have a specific commission, though the pro there, what was his name? Jim Langley? That comes to mind. He wanted me to do it. I just never got to it. I was so busy then. With all these series I was doing, I just could hardly even fit it in.
Right.
So
Sure.
it just didn't happen. But I
But
still have the pictures.
you still have the pictures, but hopefully you'll get a
Right.
commission to do that. I mean, that's just one of the classic Cypress Point on the Monterey Peninsula. That's just, you have to do that.
Yeah, it's
You
kind of
really
on the
do.
bucket list for sure. And there's places in Scotland I wish, I could do, like North Berwick and places like that I've visited. I have a lot of photographs of courses that I have not painted
Right.
that I would
Well,
like to. So
so
maybe some of those will happen now that I'm kind of just doing commission work. I don't
Right.
have such a full schedule as I used to have.
When you're not painting, Linda, what do you do with your time?
Wow. Well, I have a horse,
Oh.
and I like to ride, and I like to walk in the woods, and I like to take pictures of things that I might paint, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, I know you originally started painting landscapes, portraits, and horses, right? So have you always had horses?
I have since I've lived in South Carolina. Yeah, actually, my husband and I raised miniature horses for 20 years,
Oh.
along with having horses. So I was pretty busy back in the 90s. Too busy,
Wow.
but
So you ride every day?
no. It's been very hot. I don't ride much in the summer, but it's just starting to turn now, so it's getting nice.
More manageable. What kind of horses do you have?
I have a McCurdy plantation horse, which is a gated horse. So, yeah, very good for trail riding.
Oh, isn't that great? Well, it sounds like you have a passion for a lot of different things, and you're able to focus on your passion and paint these incredible golf courses. Spend most of your time, traveling, taking pictures of these courses, these holes, and then going back to your studio and on Spring Island and painting them. And it just very sounds like a wonderful way to spend the time, right?
It really is. I mean, that since COVID came around, I pretty much do the same thing that I usually do. So it
Exactly.
hasn't
Your life has
affected me
changed
too
much.
much.
You've always social distanced, right, by being an artist.
Pretty much, yeah.
Well,
Pretty
thank you
much.
so much for joining me, Linda. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I look forward to seeing you at a upcoming golf event or, function. We run into each other
That would be nice.
occasionally every year. And
Yeah.
continued success. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate your having me on your wonderful show, for sure.
Thanks so much. Renowned
All right.
golf landscape artist, Linda Hartow. Sports Interview with Anne Liguori is brought to you by Peak Vision Sunglasses, Zero Distortion, and Patented Dual Zone Lens Technology. Learn more at peakvision, peakvision.com. And by Dune Jewelry and my new Hamptons Robe Collection. savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or spot in timeless pieces for men and women. Dune, D-U-N-E, jewelry.com. If that music doesn't get you going, I don't know what will. Alex Lifeson, legendary guitarist for Rush, joins me now. Alex, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Anne. It's nice to be back.
It's good to talk with you, man. Just legendary guitarist. Such an honor, really. And, of course, golf connected us in the first place. We met at Robbie Krieger's tournament, Scotty Medlock's charity tournament,
right?
In
yeah.
California.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Still in touch with those guys all the time. Actually, I probably talk to Scotty once a month.
Oh, I love it. Scotty, yeah. what an artist, what a talent he is. I got to get Scotty on the show.
Yeah, but, very sweet guy, too.
You know, it's so refreshing to see how so many musicians have a passion for golf. You, Alice Cooper, Robbie, the late Glenn Frey, Kenny G, Justin Timberlake, Vince Gill.
Sure.
What about the game attracts the musician in you, Alex?
You know, a lot of it has to do with just being engaged on the road. Being on the road, I mean, it seems like a glamorous thing, and it is very unique and interesting and fun, but it's also really, it's depressing at times, and you just feel like you're locked into your hotel room until you actually go to the gig. So golf became an escape for me, certainly. And some days I play two rounds, have lunch in between, and make it a full day. And it just gets you out of your room and into an environment that's healthy and clear. You meet a lot of nice people, and you're outside swinging your club. You're getting some exercise. You're getting some sunshine. All of those things are really important when you're trapped inside a hotel room.
So you would bring your clubs everywhere.
Oh, I bring my clubs everywhere, including up to my hotel room every night, and I would chip in the morning on the carpet, or I put a couple pillows up and hit some.
I love it.
One time, I forget where it was. There were a few of us, and we were sort of trapped. The weather was crappy. We pulled the mattresses off the beds and put them up against the window, and just hit driver into these mattresses. So, I mean, low drivers, of course.
I love that that image. I can just see you guys knocking these balls into mattresses. I'm sure the hotel loved that.
I don't think they ever quite found out about it. But
well, can you make any comparisons at all, like the technique of mastering the electric and acoustic guitar to the challenge of learning golf, maybe to hit a chip shot or an iron shot?
You know, people say tempo is such an important thing, and they automatically assume that as a musician you have a better sense of tempo than say the layman. But I find that the things that work with me and don't work with me, my wrists tend to be quite supple from playing the way I play. And most guitarists are like that. So when I hold on a club, I'm a little too loose in my wrists, I feel. I'd like to have a better solid feel as I take the club back. Maybe I'm making that up as an excuse for my crappy shot, but that's something that I've kind of wondered about. Tempo is so important. You know, you finish your swing with the right tempo. You make your turn, everything. If you're too fast, your arms go forward and you start casting and all of these things. But it's a really hard thing to do, even when you have a normal sense of musical tempo. It's really hard to get that right kind of speed to the swing. And that's always a work in progress for me.
Well, it sounds like, you guys are all perfectionists as musicians. I mean, Rush was just a genius. And how does that carry over to your golf game? Do you feel like you're almost too much a perfectionist on the golf course?
Yeah, I would say sometimes it's a bit of a curse. Every shot has to be perfect. And I think a lot of golfers put this pressure on them. And it takes the fun out of the game. It becomes a little too serious. It's easy to get angry at yourself or at the game or at your ball or at your clubs, because it's always your ball or your clubs. It's never you. And it's just that kind of a crazy game that you just want to be perfect. You want to be as good as you can every round that you play. And once you start taking the pressure off, and I'm sure many golfers have found this, those rounds where you score really, really well usually are those rounds where you're not even thinking about what you're doing. You just kind of go out and play, and you don't have any expectations. And, you know, you hit the ball great, and you score great, and you putt great. Everything's happening. So you know that it's inside you somewhere to pull out. Like the pros, they need to do that every time they play, every time they practice, every time they address a golf ball. They have to be perfect.
So. Was that cruise control similar to when you get in a zone like that on the golf course? Is that similar to perhaps how you were on stage?
Absolutely. There's a correlation there for sure. Your best nights are the nights where you're not even aware of your playing. You're looking out at the crowd, and it's like your mind is floating. It's not like you're paying attention to something else. Your mind just kind of floats, and the only thing you're aware of is getting out of the way of what you're doing. And perhaps that's the way the pro golfers are, or any professional athlete operates. I mean, I watched The Last Dance last week, and it was so fascinating to watch Michael Jordan. I forgot how amazing he was, how he could move and switch and in midair in a millisecond. It looks great, slow motion. It looks like it was all planned, but wow, to have that kind of skill and foresight and connection with your body and your head, that's amazing.
Yeah, and it was like choreographed. It's just something of beauty, really.
Yeah, and certainly Tiger was that. So many great golfers have that ability.
Well, I know you taught yourself how to play guitar when you were 12. What about golf? When and how did you get started in golf?
I was a latecomer to golf. I mean, when we were kids, we played hockey a lot on the street. And I remember John, who was our original drummer, his dad had some golf clubs. And we would take some of those clubs out and just knock a ball around every once in a while. And I caddied when I was, I guess, when I was 11 or so. At a local, I remember I got 75 cents and a Coke for for working the whole round. I lost the train of thought here.
Just when you started.
Yeah, so I started when I was 37. I was a very late bloomer. I didn't think golf was that interesting a game. I didn't really watch it. I'd watch the majors if I happened to be in front of a TV, but I was never really into golf. I was into a lot of other things. And then I went on my 37th birthday to a local driving range, and just on a whim, got a few buckets of balls and hit some balls. Oh, my God, I was addicted at that moment. My hands were bleeding. I came back the next day and bought a set of clubs at this public facility. A month later, I joined this big, fancy, schmancy golf club, and then I bought 3 sets of clubs, and then I never looked back after that. In fact, I guess it was 14 years ago, I got involved in Coppenwood, which is a Tom Fazio, the first Tom Fazio golf club here in Canada, as one of the members. There were as one of the owners, there were 7 of us that put this the club together. We were dissatisfied with the club that we were at and thought, let's build our own place that's going to be amazing, and we won't have these complaints. And that's what we ended up doing.
I love that. Just build your own course.
Well, it was a little more complicated than that. And it's a great way to lose a lot of money fast.
Right.
That's what I really learned about it.
But I know Celine Dion told me, I had the opportunity to golf with her years ago for my show on the Golf Channel. And she and her husband, Renee, they bought Le Mirage in Montreal. Golf course, because they wanted their own private club. They didn't want to, wait for tea times. So they bought their own golf course.
Yeah.
But, I really enjoyed watching the documentary on Rush, Beyond the Lighted Stage. You and Geddy Lee and Neil Peart all grew up in Canada from humble beginnings. And, the amazing thing is you all stay together for over 40 years. And that doesn't happen in the world of rock and roll too often.
Oh, that doesn't happen in the world, period.
Exactly.
We, from the beginning, Geddy and I were friends from junior high school, and we had such a love of music. We would jam, after school I'd go to his place or he'd come to mine, and we would jam for a couple hours almost every day. And it was a dream of any adolescent male to join a rock band and, you know, pick up chicks and this whole thing. But for us, the music was so important, and it was really about becoming a good musician and the best at what you do. And we started early with that, and that was the underlying reason for what we were doing. And when Neil joined the band, he was so skilled, even at that early stage, that it was inspiring to Geddy and me, and we just kind of moved as a unit. We also shared a very similar sense of humor, so the time that we spent together when we weren't focused on music was like being with your very best friends all the time. And then you got to travel and see this other world and live this experience that you only ever dreamed about. And you got to do it together with guys that you really loved. So it was a no-brainer, really, for us. We were really, really fortunate because I know lots of bands that imploded. The guys just couldn't stand each other after a while, or there was competition or jealousy over who wrote what song and who made what money and all of that stuff. We were always very democratic in the way we ran things. If it wasn't a unanimous decision doing something, we didn't do it. If there was a royalty payment because someone wrote something, the whole band shared in it. You know, that took out a lot of the stress and angst and the kind of jealousy and anger that can develop in some bands.
Sure. And I want to, you know, wish you condolences on the loss of Neil Peart, who fought a courageous battle with brain cancer for, what, over 3 years and passed away a couple of months ago. I mean, you guys played together for over 40 years. You all were like brothers.
Yeah, we were. We were beyond brothers. It was more like we were, you know, we'd been in a war together, and we had this connection that would, even when we didn't see each other for months, or, you know, it was like we just left, you know, the day before. And we picked it up where we left off. It was always like that with us. And we always stayed in touch. And I'm in touch with Geddy regularly. Before this whole COVID-19 pandemic situation happened, you know, Ged and I would see each other every week. We'd go for dinner or at least talk to each other. It's been a little crazier now because of this whole thing and this adjustment that we've made these last few months, but we're still in touch and we'll always have that friendship right to the end of our days.
I mean, do you miss performing? Do you think there's any chance that you and Geddy will do some concerts together?
I miss performing in its essence. Get on stage playing, especially when you're really in good shape, you've rehearsed and you know everything and you know, it's effortless. I do miss that aspect of it. I don't miss the touring. The only thing of touring that I miss is not playing golf every day in a different fantastic golf club. But the rest of it, you know, sitting in a hotel room, being away from my family, being away from friends, I mean, it's a price you pay. And when, in a whole scope of things, it's not that great a price for the return. But still, after 40 years of being away from your family, particularly, it becomes difficult. And after now, it's been almost 5 years since the last tour, I can't say that I really miss it at this point. Maybe a year or two after we stopped, I probably missed it more. But I've settled into it now, and I quite like my life and what I'm doing. And I keep active in music, and I, you know, I'm just so in love with golf during the summer, and I'm close to my family. It's a very good balance for me.
Do you guys ever talk about maybe going back on stage?
Not really. I, you know, it's been difficult. You know, after Neil passed in January, I've played very little guitar. I don't feel inspired and motivated. It was the same thing when his daughter died in a car accident in 1997. I didn't really play for about a year. And I just don't feel it in my heart right now. Every time I pick up a guitar, I just aimlessly kind of mess around with it and put it down after 10 minutes. Normally, I would pick up the guitar and I would play for a couple of hours without even, you know, being aware that I'm spending that much time. So I know it'll come back, and I think Geddy working on his book for those couple of years, he was so involved in that book, which is, by the way, a fabulous book. When he finished it, he went on a tour for a year promoting it. You know, every time I spoke to him about getting back together, it was like, you know, yeah, when I get through this, when I get through this, when I get through this. And then always something comes up, I guess. And I don't know if the motivation is there for us to really do anything now. We're certainly proud of our track record, and we still love music, but it's different now.
Sure, I'm sure. Alex Lifeson, the legendary guitarist for Rush, joining me, passionate golfer, and you all had to have been aware of how deeply your lyrics connected to your fans, Alex. I mean, Rush was often referred to as the thinking man's band. What was the process like? I mean, did you have the melodies first, then put the lyrics to it, or vice versa, or what was it like?
Well, right from the beginning, when Neil joined the band, neither Getty or I really wanted to write lyrics. That was a huge, you know, obstacle for us. So we broached Neil about it. I mean, we could see that he was a reader. He read constantly on the road. When we first met him, he always had, half a dozen books with him, and he just plowed through them. So we thought, you know, maybe he'd be interested in writing lyrics. And we asked him, and he said, you know, I hadn't thought of it, but yeah, I'll give it a whirl. And of course, it was a great decision. It took the pressure off us, certainly. And he became a great writer, not only of music lyrics, but of the books that he published as well. And I think he was a very, very intelligent guy, very thoughtful. He had a broad knowledge of a lot of things, and he had strong opinions. And when he started writing lyrics, I'd say that, you know, he wrote with, you know, metaphorically about, you know, placing things in the future in space or in the past, and that sword and sorcerer sort of thing until the kind of the late 70s. And then he started writing in a more observational mode, commenting on things around him, relationships, global issues, and things like that. And he wrote it in such a way that I think readers could really grasp his meaning, but at the same time develop their own ideas about what the songs mean. And that was a great thing for any fan, because then they have their own interpretation of what the song means to them. And at the end of the day, that's what the important thing is. You can have your own idea of what it is, but if someone has their idea of what the meaning is and they hold it true to their heart, you know, then that's a very personal thing. We, Getty and I, always were focused on the music, so we always wrote the music, and Neil always wrote the lyrics. That gave us a three-way division in the songwriting as well, and it made it easy for us to be fair about how we were processing, you know, the publishing end of the songs that we were writing.
What a winning combination, really. You all were so fearless, which is, you know, which I think was a key. So back to golf. When you play golf, you know, you have to be really relaxed and mellow, right? But when you guys were on stage, you had so much intensity. Every night, it was like, you know, having the intensity of a game seven, right? So how difficult is it for you to transform from that onstage personality that you brought all the time to, like, that calm and cool persona that you really have to be a good golfer?
Yeah, there are similarities. I think before a show, you arrive at the gig, there's a sound check at 4:30 till 6 o'clock, and then there's sort of that dead period from 6 o'clock or 6:30 till showtime, which was usually around 7:30. So you had an hour to just sit back, and quite often we would read or get on your iPad, or always a half hour before the show, I would warm up. We'd all actually have our own rooms and warm up before the show for a good half hour before. Walking down the hallway up to the stage set the tone really for the way you needed to feel emotionally before going on stage. And that walk was always just exactly that. I had my in-ears in my ears, my monitors, so I couldn't hear anything around me. My pack was not turned up yet, so it was a quiet walk to the stage. And that, I think, it just got your heart rate down. It made you kind of more settled into what was coming, because the next 3 hours, it was all about intense concentration. A lot of times you don't notice the audience. You're so, you know, so involved in the concentration of playing those crazy songs. And there are a lot of notes in Rush songs.
Right.
And you want to play them in the right sequence and efficiently. So it became, that was the most tiring thing, I think, of performing live. It wasn't the physical part of it. It was more the mental drain. And you came off stage really exhausted in that way, particularly if you had a really, really good night. Or sometimes, even if it wasn't a very good night, that made it even more difficult.
Right. So I can't imagine like how you turn that off when you're playing golf just to be calm and cool. But gosh, Alex, I could talk with you for hours, but we're out of time. So
okay.
Thank you so much, Alex Lifeson of Rush. Hit 'em straight and keep playing, man. It's great to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure, and thank you.
My thanks to renowned golf landscape artist Linda Harto, to Alex Lifeson, legendary guitarist for Rush, and to Kyle Lynch, our studio engineer. Have a great weekend, everybody. Enjoy autumn and October. Be kind to one another, and I'll talk to you next Saturday morning from 7 to 8, right here on Sports Interview with Ann LaGorrie.